This is Kevin Lyles, president of the Atlanta Photojournalism Seminar, and you're listening to the Petapixel Photography Podcast with Sharky James. Hope you enjoy.
Welcome to the Petapixel Photography Podcast, episode 120. Microsoft giveth, while Apple taketh away. In this episode, Microsoft debuts useful tools for photographers, Apple gives and takes away, again, we discuss a handful of things it would be nice to have in cameras here in 2016, a social media service gets the axe, and why it's good to diversify, World Press Photo announces a much less stringent contest, and Afghan Girl gets arrested. All that and more in episode 120 of the Petapixel Photography Podcast. Thank you so much for opening the show, Kevin. I greatly appreciate it, brother. Kevin Lyles is a documentary, portrait, and commercial photographer based in Atlanta, Georgia, who frequently shoots assignments for the New York Times, Sports Illustrated, USA Today Sports Images, Getty, the Atlanta Braves, and so much more. Needless to say, Kevin is very good at what he does. He also serves as the president of the Atlanta Photojournalism Seminar, the longest continuously running photojournalism seminar in the United States. This awesome seminar is known for its incredible instruction on both photography and video by some of the country's top photojournalists, along with great speakers from the photojournalism world, access to the latest and greatest gear, portfolio reviews, and a photography contest with more than $5,000 in prizes. If you want to attend it this year, there's still time. It runs this November 11th and 12th, 2016 in Atlanta, Georgia. So if you're interested in checking that out, there's still some spots left as I record this. And you can find out a bunch more information about the Atlanta Photojournalism Seminar over at photojournalism.org. Now to see Kevin's awesome work, head on over to his website at kevindlyles.com. That's K-E-V-I-N-D-L-I-L-E-S. .com, and you'll be happy you did. And I'd like to thank you all for joining us here in episode 120 of the Petapixel Photography Podcast. We appreciate you all so much, and thank you all for subscribing, rating, and reviewing us in iTunes or wherever else you listen to us. And as always, we appreciate you hitting that subscribe button so you don't miss a single episode, as well as telling all your friends on social media and elsewhere and helping to get the word out about this show. Okay, with that, I'm your host, Sharky James. Let's hit it. I've been a hardcore ride or die Apple fanboy for decades now, and it's not often I get excited about anything on the PC side of things. But this week, Microsoft introduced a couple of cool things, which photographers might want to have a serious look at. The big thing that they announced, pun intended, is the Surface Studio, and it has its sights squarely on the computer that I use and love, the Apple 27-inch 5K Retina iMac. This new offering from Microsoft is part PC, part graphics tablet, and part drafting table. It features a 4,500 by 3,000 resolution 28-inch PixelSense touchscreen LCD with true color technology, which lets you change color spaces on the fly and can be used at varying angles so it's more comfortable to interact with whether you're sitting or standing. The company also introduced a really cool device called the Surface Dial, which is basically a wireless puck, for lack of a better term, that costs just $100, works with all Surface devices, and for a limited time will actually be included for free for those who pre-order the Surface Studio. You place the Surface Dial on the screen, and turning it much as you would with any knob allows you to switch between features, change brush sizes and colors, and of course, you can even use it to change your volume. Now, if you're seated in front of the Surface Studio, I don't see people having their arm up all day long with that little knob on the screen turning it, because your arm's going to get tired. So you're probably going to use that in a configuration where you're seated a little bit higher. You're looking down at that Surface Studio. You've got it on there, that dial, and you're turning it, and gravity is keeping it on there. That's doing most of the work for you. Either way, this Surface Dial is pretty cool. A lot of people are going to find amazing uses for this, and it's not something that Apple has, unfortunately. I think it's worth noting, though, that for well over a decade or so, you've been able to get USB devices that basically do the same thing. But with this Surface Dial, you put it on the actual screen. There's really no benefit to having it on the screen, I think. It's just kind of cool. According to Microsoft Windows VP Terry Meyerson, quote, "Every now and then in pursuing our mission, we see the opportunity to create a new category of device. We seize these moments to create something so much more than a product," end quote. All right, back to the much cooler thing, the Surface Studio. When you compare that to Apple's 27-inch iMac, the screen is wider, it's thinner, and it does a whole lot more. Not only that, but being a touchscreen and being able to be used as a tablet for those that wish to use a stylus, can draw, etc., gives it so much more added functionality that is not available on my beloved iMac, without adding other things like a Wacom tablet and taking up desk space and all the extra expense. The new Microsoft Surface Studio PC is available for pre-order right now in three different configurations starting at $3,000 US. And if I wasn't so deep in the Apple ecosystem, I think I'd give one of these a serious look because they are really, really cool. They look to be an amazing product. And you know what? I think Microsoft has a real winner on its hands here, and Apple needs to step up the game. iMacs need to be touchscreen. They need to do all the cool things that these Surface Studio PCs do, because otherwise they're going to look a little bit old-timey. Also announced by Microsoft is something for those who don't need a ginormous screen, but need something that's powerful that they can take with them on the road. And that's the new Surface Book i7. It looks just like the model it replaces, only this one gets quite a boost under the hood with a super fast NVIDIA GeForce GTX 965M 2GB GPU, that's a graphics processing unit or graphics card, alongside an Intel Core i7 processor. What Microsoft has done here seems pretty simple and rather boring, but they've added a second fan inside to keep this laptop cooler so it can deliver twice the graphics power without overheating. Something else that's going to be very much appreciated is that the battery can now last an astonishing 16 hours. That represents a full 30% more than the model it replaces. Now, this new Surface Book, as you might imagine, is not cheap. You're looking at paying $2,400 US for one of these speed demons. They're available for pre-order right now, and you can get them in your hands as early as November 10th of 2016. Next. In the latest episode of TWIP, host Frederick Van Johnson talked about the three things that he would like to see in today's cameras. And I'd like to talk a little bit more about that because he and I are in complete agreement on this. This also ties into what my friend and listener Joshua and I were recently talking about this past Friday. He asked me how Nikon could possibly survive when their cameras come out with fairly minor, unexciting updates, with a few exceptions here and there, and what could possibly be done to help the camera industry. He, like myself, has the Fujifilm X-T2, thanks again DigiDirect, and there are so many darn cool things in it. Not only that, Fujifilm is notorious for pushing out updates via firmware, which further extend functionality and make things a whole lot better. Really, really sweet things too. You know, we don't see that from the big too much. Okay, so let's get to Frederick's list along with my thoughts, and then I'll talk about what I think needs to be done by Canon and Nikon. So Frederick's first item on his wish list was voice control. Now think about that for a second. We talk to our smartphones. You know, think Siri on the iPhone, even though she's not very helpful. Then you've got things like the Amazon Echo, which is a device in your home which you speak to, and it asks you questions and it does things. It acts on those. So that is something out of science fiction right there that is really cool and is a reality today. So why don't we have that in our cameras, right? Imagine you're shooting, and rather than having to mess with buttons and dials and possibly missing the shot, you could tell your camera to adjust the aperture, switch modes, and on and on. That technology exists right now. So I'm with Frederick on this big time. Give us voice control. You know, like video, you don't have to use it if you don't want to, but give it to us already. I mean, it's 2016 for Pete's sake. That would be innovative right there. That would push a lot of camera sales, but no one's doing it. Now, Frederick's second wish was for cellular connectivity inside the camera. And I don't care if it has its own connection or if it just pairs better with my smartphone, kind of like Nikon's SnapBridge technology, which is certainly a step in the right direction. It's not perfect, but it's pretty darn cool. But you know what? Every camera should be able to send a photo to social media directly without having to jump through a bunch of hoops. Again, it's 2016. Come on. Whether you're a pro or an amateur, you're likely posting to social media. You know, we can take a photo on our smartphone or tablet, and seconds later, it's on Facebook, Instagram, etc. So why can't I do that as easily with my cameras? There's really no reason not to. I mean, come on, it is ridiculous. All cameras should have this, and it should be seamless. It should just work. This is partly why the camera market is in the dumps. You know, not only have smartphones largely killed off the compact camera market, you know, little point and shoots, but many are steering clear of entry-level DSLRs and mirrorless bodies too, because they view their smartphone as being good enough, and I'm doing air quotes there, and it's the path of least resistance to getting photos and videos to their social media accounts. Not only that, you can live stream video to all of those accounts directly from your phone or from your tablet. Your camera, not so much. So these are areas where the camera makers can improve, and you know what? Maybe they'll sell more cameras. Imagine that, right? It doesn't seem like they really want to sell cameras anymore, does it? Now, Frederick's third wish was for an amazing app store to extend the functionality of the camera. You know, Sony has its Play Memory Store, but it's kind of dead, and the offerings really aren't super exciting. The integration isn't great. I mean, look at Sony's menu systems. They're horrid. So what do you think their app store is going to be like, right? With the huge installed base that Canon and Nikon systems have, there's an opportunity there for apps of all types. You know, if it works with smartphones, make it work with our cameras. You know, give us ways to do more things easily. Even if we have to pay a dollar or two here to get an app to do more things, that would be okay. You know, to Frederick's list, I would add articulating touchscreens. If you make shooting higher and lower angles easier for people with a movable screen like that, people are going to use it to be more creative, they'll enjoy their photography more, and as a result, maybe they'll stay in your system instead of looking to see what the competition has. I mean, that just makes a lot of sense right there. And what's way beyond ridiculous is that here in late 2016, most of the cameras out there have LCD screens that can't be operated via touch. I mean, this is how people are used to operating their smartphones, tablets, etc. They want that functionality in their cameras as well. But for some reason, the camera companies don't exactly get that. If they did, it would be in all cameras. And the fact that it's not is frankly embarrassing. I mean, come on, the camera makers really shouldn't be surprised that people aren't buying cameras like they used to. You're holding back features that people want that would actually sell cameras. And then they're surprised that they're not doing it. Every time Canon and Nikon come out with a new camera and it doesn't have all or even some of these things in it, it just really blows my mind. You know, these things aren't hard to do, so do them. Make Frederick, Joshua, and I happy. Next. Not to be left out, Apple announced its new MacBook Pro laptop with a feature that seems kind of cool, but really doesn't seem to be lighting the world on fire as they perhaps hoped. Amazingly, this week marks 25 years since Apple's first notebook computer. It was a heavy beast, but hey, it let you get things done on the road, so that was okay. It also helped you work on your arms, too. I mean, this is how heavy this thing was. It was huge. Well, the new MacBook Pro has the best Retina display that the company has ever put in a laptop, and it's smaller, and it's lighter than ever before. Quite a contrast to their first notebook computer a quarter of a century ago. But it's that new strip above the top row of keys, which Apple calls a touch bar, which changes depending on what application you're using, that is drawing the most attention because it's unlike anything that's been in a Mac laptop before. A cool feature, yes, and I would totally use the heck out of it if I had it, but it seems kind of gimmicky to me. I don't know. I mean, I'd have to use it for a while to know for sure. But in Apple's video showing off this feature, they showed a line of emojis on it, and that didn't help. Seriously, we'll see how useful it is as photographers. I mean, you're able to customize that touch bar, and applications will present the most obvious choices to you depending on what you're doing at the time. So that could be helpful. But I see a lot of people typing, using the trackpad, which is larger, then leaning over to look at those icons to figure out what's there, what they need to press. And you know what? I don't think what we need is more buttons. Others take away things to simplify them, but Apple thinks that what we'd like more is more buttons. Wow, you know, that is innovation right there. Again, I'm a hardcore Apple fanboy, but a changeable row of additional buttons just isn't doing it for me. These new MacBook Pros are smaller and lighter, as I said, with the 13-inch coming in 23% smaller than its predecessor and weighing in at just 3 pounds, while the 15-inch is 20% smaller and comes in at 4 pounds. Their displays are 67% brighter, have 67% higher contrast, and also are able to show 25% more colors. Okay, this is a bit, hey you kids, get off my lawn, but aren't laptops bright enough as it is? I mean, have you ever thought about that? I have to turn my screen down because it feels like I'm illuminating my soul with my laptop, and it's quite old. 67% brighter than the previous model from a couple years ago? I mean, how bright is bright enough already? At some point, they're going to be so bright that you're going to have to turn them all the way down. So I don't get why they keep making the laptops brighter and brighter. They seem just fine the way they are. Anyhow, these new MacBook Pros include Touch ID for logging in with your finger. You get to choose the finger, of course. I think you know which one I'm choosing right now. It has a dedicated Siri key so Siri can help you not find stuff since she's horrible at being helpful. It has a revamped cooling system. Well, it's true. Super fast SSD, 4 Thunderbolt 3 ports, and 10-hour battery life. If these new MacBook Pros excite you, they start at $1,799 US for the 13-inch model, $2,399 for the 15-inch model, and if you don't care about the touch bar, you can save $300 and get yourself a 13-inch MacBook Pro without one right now. A friend of mine just ordered his MacBook Pro, and he brought up a great point. What is Apple's obsession with thinner and lighter? Just like with the brightness thing. Aren't they tiny enough as it is? I mean, I think most of us would happily settle for last year's thickness and weight, which was good enough, mind you, at the time, and we can get better battery life. Microsoft's new laptop will last for 16 hours before you have to recharge it. These Apple MacBook Pros, though, only 10 hours. Think about that for a second. Quick math tells us that Microsoft's laptop will last 60% longer than the MacBook Pros. Come on. Are we trying to get work done, or is that extra weight really going to be make or break? I think that most of us would happily carry a little bit heavier laptop for 6 more hours of getting work done when we're on the road or we're not near an outlet or whatever, right? I know I would. Now, while these MacBook Pros have a headphone port, unlike the iPhone 7s, all the ports are now USB Type-C. Those are the ones that you can plug in either direction, and they work just fine. The problem with this is now you're going to need dongles for everything. If you have Thunderbolt devices, that's a $50 dongle. USB devices, another overpriced dongle for each of them. Oh, and the SD card slot, gone. So much for popping in the card from your camera. Now you're going to need a card reader again, and that is very annoying. I get that eventually, in the name of progress, again, doing air quotes, that we have to move to different type of connectors with more functionality, etc. But these are incredibly expensive laptops for most people. And now everyone needs to spend like an extra $100 or so to get dongles, a card reader, etc., and then carry around those things with them. And if you don't have it, then suddenly you can't use your devices. And that's a problem. Apple may have gone a little bit too far this time. And in other ways, not far enough. Those Microsoft Surface Books are starting to look really good for a whole lot of people. And this is coming from a hardcore Apple fanboy. Maybe I'm not as hardcore anymore. I don't know. Apple needs to step up their game here. Next. You know, I often talk about not putting all your eggs in one basket as it relates to using one card slot when you have two in your camera, putting all your images on one hard drive and then not having a backup, etc. And this is generally great advice all around when you think about it. And social media is no exception to that. It doesn't matter if you do photography for a living or if you're just trying to get your work out there and be seen. It's important to diversify, I think. For me, as I record this on October 29th, 2016, I have over 18,800 plus kind people following me on Instagram and 7,700 plus people on Twitter. You know, Instagram is more visual, of course. Twitter is more words. They try to add photos and video, but it really doesn't catch on. That's not where you're going to look at photos and video. You go to Instagram, and maybe sometimes you go to Facebook for that. It just blows my mind how many people focus on just one service, especially if they're in business. You know, I get it. People are busy. You're trying to run your business. You've got a family. You have a lot of things pulling you in many directions. But imagine how busy you're going to be when your service of choice, let's say it's Instagram, dries up. You know, a lot of people can't imagine that happening. But look at MySpace, for instance. Back in the day, it was the bee's knees. Everyone was using MySpace. And then Facebook came along. But Facebook has been trailing off for many people. You know, it's harder and harder to reach people that are following you, whether they're your friends, your family, or you just have a bunch of followers. So now Vine is going away. Granted, the 6-second looping video service hasn't been widely used by photographers, but it really doesn't matter at this point. Its recently announced demise should really serve as a cautionary tale. Putting all your eggs in one basket is not a good way to go. It's important to take the time to diversify and make sure you're covered in case your basket of choice, the sole basket that you have all your eggs in, decides to go away. Because when that actually happens, it's going to be like starting from scratch. And if photography is your business, that should really scare you. You know, Facebook, for instance, wants you to pay to reach the audience that you built up over time. You might have really, really worked at it, and now you can't reach everybody. They want you to pay to reach everyone. And Instagram, which is owned by Facebook, by the way, is heading in this direction as well. You can pay to boost your post. And just in general, you're not able to reach everybody like you used to be able to. Their algorithm decides what you see and when. You'll notice if you look in your feed, the first thing might say 17 hours ago, and then the next thing is like 3 minutes ago. So it's trying to decide what to show you. You're not seeing everything. Those that are following you aren't seeing everything as well. So they want to encourage you to spend money to boost those posts so everyone will see it, when before, you didn't have to do that. And don't even get me started on Twitter. I mean, that thing's been on the decline for years. It is a hot mess, but a lot of people are still using it. It's just so hard to get signal through the noise there. It's mostly noise. So my advice to photographers is to be on all services that matter these days. And when new things come out that look like they're getting some traction, get in there early. Listen, I know it's a pain and it takes a lot of time, but the effort is worth it. And when one of these services get the axe, you'll be happy that you spread things around and you don't have all your eggs in that basket. And the same thing goes for shooting to multiple cards when possible and backing those images up. Hopefully with one copy up in the cloud or at someone else's house. So if you have a fire, a flood, or whatever, all your eggs didn't get burnt or waterlogged, you'll be happy that you did so and you'll have peace of mind, especially if they're family photos or this is your life's work, of course. So Vine is going away and others will over time as the next big thing comes out. Just make sure that you're everywhere that you can reasonably be when it comes to social media. For me, that's Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook, where I'm LensShark. Next. Just like my friend Jeff Widener's iconic Tank Man photo that was shot in Tiananmen Square back in 1989, former photojournalist Steve McCurry's Afghan girl image, which famously graced the cover of National Geographic way back in 1985, has really stuck in people's minds. That striking photo of that 14-year-old girl in a refugee camp with those amazing green eyes left an impact on the world, and people wondered what became of her, so Steve McCurry famously tracked her down and photographed her again. Well, this week we learned that now 46-year-old Sharbat Gula has been arrested in Pakistan for the use of a fake ID card and living in that country illegally. She was taken into custody by Pakistan's Federal Investigation Agency for the charges I mentioned, and they say that she was using the name Sharbat Bibi rather than her own, because, of course, that would be one Google search away from revealing her true identity. If she's convicted of fraud, this woman could face 7 to 14 years in jail and a fine of up to $5,000 U.S. Now, once he learned the news, photographer Steve McCurry took to Instagram where he posted his iconic photo of Gula, saying, quote, 2 hours ago, I got word from a friend in Peshawar, Pakistan, that Sharbat Gula has been arrested. We are doing everything we can to get the facts by contacting our colleagues and friends in the area. I am committed to doing anything and everything possible to provide legal and financial support for her and her family. I object to this action by the authorities in the strongest possible terms. She has suffered throughout her entire life, and her arrest is an egregious violation of her human rights. End quote. Now, it's still early and we don't know the complete details yet, but I don't understand McCurry's thinking here. Just because someone has had a hard life doesn't give them the right to break laws and get a free pass because of that. If we're going to go with this kind of thinking, then everyone who's had a tough life should just be released from prison and you get amnesty for all of your crimes. This woman happens to be famous because Steve McCurry made her famous. But what about all the other refugees who've committed crimes and no one's speaking out for them? Steve McCurry's not going to help them, right? But she was on the cover of National Geographic. She's made him presumably millions of dollars. And so he's going to help her get out. I mean, that's great for her, but she broke the law. Presumably she knew what she was doing and she did it anyhow. You know, there's a right and a wrong way of doing things. I understand when people are desperate, they do desperate things. But do we let everyone out of jail and prison because they're poor or because they had a tough life? What's the point of having laws, right? Now, when we hear how this all shakes out, we'll be sure to let you guys know, of course. And by we, I mean me. Next. As many of you know, I was a photojournalist for many years, so I take the truth in journalism and the truthfulness of photos very seriously. And for many years, you could count on World Press Photos contests fighting the good fight in that vein, but then photographers kept trying to pull a fast one on them. And last year, despite all the controversy in previous years, 20% of the finalists had to be disqualified. One in five finalists DQ'd. That is so disappointing. So following all that nonsense, World Press Photo Managing Director Lars Boring, a great guy, announced a new code of ethics in an effort at driving home the point that tinkering with your images in journalism is just not acceptable. I mean, look at the Steve McCurry scandal from earlier in 2016. Image after image with significant photoshopping, and then McCurry surprising everyone by running away from the label photojournalist. So what do you do when so many people are wanting to improve, and that's in air quotes, their photos? You create a contest where pretty much anything goes, and those who want to mess with their images will have a place just for them. And that's exactly what World Press Photo has done. Come October 2017, there's going to be a separate competition at World Press Photo for, quote, creative documentary photography, end quote. A contest designed for people who feel like their work needs an extra creative touch, something outside of journalism. Of this new contest, the organization says, quote, "This contest will be for professional visual storytellers who, in wanting to communicate about actual people, events, or issues, deploy creative techniques in constructing, processing, and presenting images. The contest will not have rules limiting how images are produced and will not have categories." End quote. Now, as useful as it may be to have a separate contest for the tinkerers, I argue that it isn't going to change much. You know, reason being that photographers want to win the contest that they've had for years now. Tarnished though it may be by the rule breakers, that is the one that you want to win. Same thing with a Pulitzer. If they introduced a side contest, a Pulitzer Junior Prize, it wouldn't be the same thing. You want to win the main prize, right? Like, I've been published in Time for Kids magazine, but it's not actual Time. You see what I'm saying here? I would love to be able to say that I've had a photo in Time magazine, but it was Time for Kids. Still pretty cool, but not Time. You get the point here. And I think that referring to this new contest as creative documentary photography is a mistake. The word creative, in my opinion, doesn't go with documentary photography. When you use words like the former, you diminish the latter, in my opinion. I think that World Press Photo needs to fight the good fight and draw a bigger distinction between the two contests. It's okay if they want to have the second one, of course, not that it's up to me, but draw a bigger distinction between the two, please. Mark my words, despite having this new contest, we're still going to see photographers try to dupe them and win the main contest. This new contest is not going to change that. I'd like to thank you all for listening to episode 120 of the Petapixel Photography Podcast. Don't forget to check us out at petapixel.com/podcast for the show notes and to see what else we have for you. If you head on over there, you can leave us a voicemail question that we can answer here on the show. Or if you don't feel comfortable leaving a voicemail, feel free to email me at lensshark@gmail.com. And if you'd like to connect with me personally, and I hope you do, hit me up on Twitter, Instagram, or Facebook, where I'm LensShark. That's LensShark. And if you got a moment, I would appreciate it if you told a friend who's into photography about this podcast and help us expand our listenership. We would greatly appreciate that. All right, with that, I'll see you all in episode 121. Well, it's f8 and 250th of a second outside. It's time to shoot.
Please subscribe to the Petapixel Photography Podcast. My daddy is the host.
I've been a hardcore rider doy. Blooper.